It's a disgrace. It's frankly a real disgrace. It's an attack on our country in a true sense.
What a leaked set of questions for the president reveals about the Mueller investigation.
The Mueller team is applying straight up the baseline norms and expectations of the rule of law, and they're just asking him, what were you thinking?
What would happen if the president answered? And a dark stain on America's longest war.
Yesterday in Afghanistan was the deadliest day since the fall of Taliban for journalists. It was a terrible day.
Our lead story this hour is the massive proposed merger between Sprint and T-Mobile and how an antitrust case that pitted the government against AT&T and Time Warner could have big consequences. This is The Takeaway for May 1st, 2018.
Hey, podcast people, it's Tanzina Vega. I'm going to be hosting this podcast starting next week, and I'm so excited that you're along for the ride. Remember, tell all of your friends to subscribe to this podcast now, and they'll get a daily dose of news, analysis, and views that you won't hear on every other news podcast. I mean real people like you. If you like it, rate it and review us on iTunes, and keep letting us know what you think. I'll see you soon on The Takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Great to have you with us today. And get out your cell phone calculator if you need it, because the number of major wireless carriers in America could be going from 4 to 3.
Today, we're announcing that T-Mobile and Sprint have reached a definitive agreement to come together and form a new, stronger company.
That enthusiastic man is T-Mobile CEO John Legere, announcing the nearly $27 billion proposed merger between the country's third and fourth largest wireless carriers over the weekend. Now, what's the advantage, according to these companies?
A company that will supercharge the Un-carrier strategy and create robust competition and lower prices across wireless, video, and broadband. A company that will create thousands of new American jobs, and the only company with the capacity to quickly create a broad and deep nationwide 5G network.
Well, John Legere sounds excited about the deal, but these two companies will now have to convince the Justice Department not to go to court to try and block this merger, which the Justice Department did in another major merger case that was in closing arguments on Monday, AT&T's proposed $85 billion acquisition of Time Warner. Now, that case could have major implications for T-Mobile and Sprint and other future mergers as well. Cecilia Kong is here, technology reporter for The New York Times. Cecilia, good to have you.
Hi, Todd.
Well, let's start with this T-Mobile-Sprint deal. John Legere is excited. We could hear it in his voice. What does he say? What do these two companies say could be gained from a merger of this size?
Well, first of all, John Legere is always excited. So he's a pretty colorful person. The T-Mobile and Sprint are the third and fourth largest carriers, and they trail quite a bit behind Verizon and AT&T in terms of the number of subscribers they have. They very much want to combine, and they've tried this before, actually two times before, because they want to be able to put together their resources, get more scale, more efficiencies, as I say, so they can compete against AT&T and Verizon. They basically want to go head-to-head with the biggest carriers who are nationwide distributors of wireless service.
Now, these companies, T-Mobile and Sprint, say this is the only way to build a super fast, viable 5G network across the country, that you need the scale to do that. Is that really true, that this is the only way to do it, or is this really about leveraging in the consumer market?
That is a stretch to say that this is the only way to create a 5G network. AT&T and Verizon are already planning and well on their way of building the same kind of network. T-Mobile and Sprint were also planning to. To say that this is the only way that the nation can develop and build a 5G network is probably not true, and it's going to be a hard argument to carry with regulators going forward. That message really is to an audience of just a few in Washington. The U.S. government, particularly the White House, has declared 5G as a vital national and economic, national security and economic interest. So that message is really geared toward the Trump administration and regulators here in Washington. Mm.
Now, then, let's talk about what consumers need to hear when they hear about a deal like this. One great thing about the cellular war, Cecilia, has been all the pressure, the downward pressure on prices, bundles, deals, lower prices as companies compete for your business. Would a deal like this, a merger like this, provide less motivation to a couple of behemoths to compete on price?
You know, that's right. The wireless industry is sort of a rare bright spot in terms of consumer prices going down over the years. And many people would point to the fact that T-Mobile and Sprint remained independent companies, and there are four wireless carriers. And to get a sense of why prices have gone down, one should look at what happened in 2014 when federal regulators at that time told T-Mobile and Sprint, no, we would not approve your merger. And so they abandoned that deal. And right after that, T-Mobile and Sprint and then Verizon and AT&T launched a series of actions that lower prices overall for the industry and all kinds of new plans, innovative plans like unlimited data. That was actually prompted by, over the last few years, by the fact that these four carriers competed very fiercely. Regulators actually dubbed John Legere as the Maverick wireless industry executive because he was so adamant about, he was so aggressive on prices and bringing them down. So to remove that sort of that equation of four carriers is going to be a hard argument to bring to this administration.
Now, Cecilia, there's a bit of merger mania going on right now in the industry. AT&T and Time Warner are trying to combine. AT&T is a cellular carrier like T-Mobile and Sprint. Time Warner, of course, on the content side. You were in the courthouse yesterday as their antitrust case winds down, the Department of Justice taking a dim view of that merger. What's going on with that case?
Yeah, this is certainly merger mania happening right now in Washington, particularly in the telecom and media space. And in closing arguments yesterday, it looked like both sides have not moved at all closer to each other. They are digging their heels on their arguments. They have very different views on how their merger would affect consumers. The Justice Department thinks that the merger would lead to higher prices for every month for cable subscribers. They even have a number on it. They say 27 cents per month. Would be the increase for the average cable or satellite subscriber. The companies, AT&T and Time Warner, are very adamant that the reverse would happen, that their merger would provide so many more, a bigger competitor to these streaming new rivals from Silicon Valley, and that this combined company, AT&T and Time Warner, would eventually be able to reduce prices overall for viewers of entertainment online as well as over cable. So they have very different views. They both sides adamantly argued against the other, and they picked apart each other's arguments. And now it's this case is in the hands of the judge, Judge Richard Leon, who is going to take the next 5 weeks or so. He's going to render an opinion on June 12th of one of the really the biggest antitrust cases to come in many, many years, and a real surprise case because these are two companies that don't directly compete. And so this kind of a lawsuit to block this kind of a merger is rare. And so the results of this will be closely watched, not just by people in telecom and media, but across corporate America, because there's so much pending interest in consolidation and mergers in many industries.
Well, the fate of the AT&T Time Warner merger now in the hands of an antitrust judge, as you said, Cecilia Kong, and lots of people waiting in the wings watching this case. Cecilia Kong, technology reporter for the New York Times. Thanks as always.
You're so welcome. Thanks.
It's Jane calling from San Francisco. We should not be paying any more than people pay in Europe, but because lawmakers have allowed a cartel to develop among the telecom companies, we do.
Corey from Sheridan. And the cell service is decent here. We get one or two bars, and it seems like we only have one internet service provider who cannot seem to give us our promised speeds, and I would love to see more cell towers built and love to see more internet service providers come in to give the one more competition.
This is Jordan from the Dalles. We have very limited choices for our internet and service providers, and with the monopoly that we have in our nation, it's in the interest of the carriers to set the rates and quality of service, leaving us with very little choice, and we pay the cost.
Well, let's get a little bit of analysis now. You know, T-Mobile and Sprint have been in merger talks in the past. Back in 2014, these two companies floated the idea. It was met with a lot of skepticism at the time by my next guest, Tom Wheeler, former chairman of the FCC. Tom, thanks for coming back.
Hey, Todd. Great to be with you.
Well, let's start off with the AT&T and Time Warner merger as it relates to T-Mobile and Sprint, because as Cecilia Kang just described, an antitrust judge will now decide if that big AT&T-Time Warner merger goes through. What can T-Mobile and Sprint take from this case, and what are they watching for in the judge's ruling?
Well, I agree with Cecilia that it is a bellwether for antitrust policy for the next multiple years, but I disagree that it has a relationship to the Sprint T-Mobile proposal, because the AT&T and Time Warner, as Cecilia pointed out, is a vertical merger, and they don't directly compete with each other today. The Sprint T-Mobile merger, however, is a horizontal merger of companies that today are violent competitors. And that competition would be removed from the market. So I think you look at the horizontal, you look at the T-Mobile Sprint a little differently than the Time Warner AT&T.
Now, that violence in competition, as you describe it, downward pressure on prices, lots of deals, lots of bundles. We mentioned it before. That violence, you could argue, has been a big benefit to people with cell phones. What'll happen if T-Mobile and Sprint manage to form one new company?
Well, I think you have to worry about what happens to competition. And consumers have been the beneficiaries of competition. I mean, you know, in the last year alone, wireless prices have gone down about 13%. Because everybody is competing with everybody else. And Sprint and T-Mobile, as Cecilia indicated, have been the leaders in creative new initiatives to spur competition. And so what we're talking about here is sacrificing the known benefits of competition, producing lower prices and innovative new services, for this unknown new technology called 5G. And I think it's a great strategy by the companies to say, hey, we're going to blow right past the impact on consumers and talk about this 5G, but that's not the real issue. The real issue is what's the impact on consumers.
Well, what's driving this merger mania? Why merge? Why get so big? They're already big. Why be gigantic?
Well, first of all, if you can do anything to reduce the amount of competition, it's good for you and your shareholders. And we've seen that. I mean, it used to be, you know, it was only, you know, a decade or so ago that there were six national wireless carriers, and they've slowly consolidated. And somebody has to draw the line. And what we tried to do in 2014 was to indicate that we were highly skeptical that that line needed to be moved down to three. And I think we've been proven right by the rewards that consumers have received as a result.
Now, what's the state, before we go, Tom Wheeler, of that skepticism in the Trump administration now? You were in the FCC in 2014, and the Trump Justice Department will take a look at this proposed merger as well.
Yes, and I hope they take a good, hard look at it. It's both the Justice Department and the FCC. The Justice Department has the job of making sure that the transaction does not jeopardize competition, and the FCC has to make a finding that the transaction advances the public interest. And I just think that going from four competitors to three competitors fails both those tests. It doesn't advance the public interest, and it does jeopardize competition.
Tom Wheeler, former chairman of the FCC 2013 to 2017. Tom, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, Todd.
We're gaining new insight into Robert Mueller's special counsel investigation into Russian interference in the U.S. election. On Monday night, the New York Times published a list of nearly four dozen questions given to President Trump's legal team by the special counsel. The questions touch on a broad range of topics: the firing of FBI Director James Comey, the firing of Michael Flynn, and what the president knew about his contact with Russians, and also what the president may have known about contacts between Russians and his presidential campaign. This morning on Twitter, the president called the leak disgraceful and said that none of the questions are about collusion. Ryan Goodman is editor-in-chief of Just Security and a former special counsel in the Defense Department. He joins me now to dig into these questions a little bit. Ryan, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Ryan, as you look down through this list of four dozen questions that the president may or may not answer in the Mueller investigation, what do you see? What's the pattern? What do you think Robert Mueller is looking for within these questions?
So I think one big point is that there is a live investigation on collusion. There were some earlier news reports that he was only going to focus questions on obstruction. So I think that's one revelation, that there's a good portion here that's focused squarely on the Russia campaign interference. So I think that's one issue. And then the second issue is how the questions on obstruction are so finely focused on the president's intent, which is the key element to prove in any kind of an obstruction case in terms of a criminal investigation.
Now, Ryan, the president says in his tweet this morning that there are no questions on collusion. You're saying precisely the opposite.
I count at least 13 questions on collusion. I saw the president's tweet. I don't know how else you could interpret something like the following: what knowledge do you have of any outreach by your campaign, including by Paul Manafort, to Russia about the potential assistance to the campaign? There's another question about, quote, what do you know about communication between Roger Stone, his associates, Julian Assange, or WikiLeaks? And there are others. When did you know about the Trump Tower meeting? I don't think there's any other way to frame or understand that but that it's dealing with potential crimes related to campaign interference by the Russians. And in some sense, I think this just proves that the term collusion has been used and abused by the president and others to become almost meaningless. How could anybody look at this and not worry if they were his defense attorneys that this is exactly one of the main areas of focus of the special counsel?
Now, that first question that you mentioned, and I'm paraphrasing, what did you know about outreach from your campaign, including from Paul Manafort, former campaign manager, to Russians? Now, that's a line of questioning that appears to be new, as I understand it. Not simply Russians reaching out to Americans or asking for meetings in Trump Tower, but a suggestion that there might have been members of the Trump campaign, Paul Manafort in this case, reaching the other way, reaching to Russia.
That's right. This is, I would say, utterly new. You know, I've been tracking this as closely as I can, and I don't know of any reporting that has suggested it moving in this direction. There are ways in which you could read the Steele dossier to indicate something like this, but otherwise, just not. So it's a whole new line of questions that I think raises a certain specter over the investigation. I think the other implication that I draw from this question is it kind of goes to show why the House Intelligence Committee wrapped up their investigation prematurely. I thought that was always going to be inevitable, that there would be news revelations or something like this that would kind of put egg on their face of showing them, look, there's so much more evidence that's still out there that you guys wrapped up and closed this off well before you should have. And I think this is one pretty startling indication of it.
Now, we should reiterate, Ryan, there's no indication yet that the president is going to sit down with Robert Mueller. He has said he wants to be questioned by Robert Mueller, wants to clear the air. His lawyers don't want him to do that. And in fact, one member of his legal team left, thinking that the president wasn't following his advice on this. But if that ever happened, what would Robert Mueller be trying to elucidate? I mean, even if the president didn't answer questions truthfully, even if the president told stories and lied about parts of his interactions, a sitting president can't be indicted for a crime, according to the Justice Department. So what would be the end game here?
It's difficult to know the end game. I think one piece, at least, is that Robert Mueller wants to create a comprehensive report that wraps up everything he knows. So he could, in that report, indicate whether or not he thinks there's probable cause that the president was involved in crimes, though he could not indict him as a sitting president. He could do something like that in the report. The other, you know, option here that might very well turn out is that Robert Mueller could still name the president as an unindicted co-conspirator while indicting others. And a number of these potential crimes obviously involve potential conspiracy, so it wouldn't just be the president acting alone. And that's another way in which this might play out. And then the third is, it is true that the Justice Department is operating under their own guidelines and an opinion from the, two opinions from the Office of Legal Counsel that a sitting president cannot be indicted, but it is also true that once he leaves office, he could be indicted, and even those Office of Legal Counsel opinions say so. So I do think if this is the time for the investigation and there's a later time for an indictment, that might also be the game that Robert Mueller is forced to play in a certain sense.
Well, let's talk a little bit of politics before we let you go, Ryan, because it is a big part of this. The president calls these leaks disgraceful. He seems to be suggesting that they may have come from within Robert Mueller's team. I don't know if there's any actual evidence of that. I'm asking you to speculate, of course, but do you think these leaks came from Robert Mueller or his team?
I think it's highly, highly unlikely. I'd almost think it's like that's the last place I would look. The one thing that most close observers have said about this entire investigation is how tight a lid Mueller has kept on any leaks coming out of his team. And there have been so many surprises in terms of plea agreements that had been made months earlier. And when they're disclosed to the public, everybody's just amazed that there was just been no leaking out of the Mueller team. So it seems like the president is raising something of which I have no evidence out there in the public that would even be able to build any kind of an inference that it came from Mueller's team. There's much more speculation that it came from people on his side or people who are even trying to help himself. By putting it out in the public so that he will see all of these kinds of commentaries and realize that it's not in his interest necessarily to interview with Mueller. So I think that's the more plausible part of it. Mueller's team is the least plausible explanation for where this came from.
Ryan Goodman, Editor-in-Chief of Just Security, a former special counsel at the Defense Department. Ryan, it's always great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If you like what you're hearing, give us a rating and review us on iTunes. It helps us in ways you can't imagine. Also, tell your friends. Share this podcast on Facebook or Twitter or wherever you want your followers to get some solid news coverage. They'll be smarter and they'll think you're a hero. It's a win-win. All right, now back to the show.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick. And 20 years ago today, Spike Lee's basketball film, He Got Game, opened in movie theaters across the country.
It might feel good, it might sound a little something, but damn the game, if it don't mean nothing. What is game? Who got game? Where's the game in life? Behind the game, I got game, she got game.
The movie starred Ray Allen, the now NBA legend Ray Allen, as Jesus Shuttleworth, the number one high school basketball prospect in America. Jesus has a fraught relationship with his father, recently out of prison, played by Denzel Washington.
Why in the hell did you name me Jesus anyway? What type of name is that?
Jesus!
It's a biblical name.
No kidding.
I pray that you understand why I pushed you. I was the one who put the ball in your crib.
I ain't no baby no more.
Well, now, 20 years after the release of He Got Game, we have a new trailer that imagines a sequel, She Got Game.
There has been a second coming of Jesus, Shuttlesworth. 20 years to the date, Lincoln High School has once again produced the most sought-after high school basketball prospect. Coney Island, known for its high crime rates and rampant drug use, Faith Mothershed has overcome the odds.
This is your moment.
The short film, commissioned by Bleacher Report, stars Jewel Lloyd as Faith Mothershed as she decides what to do with her own future. Play at a top university, stay close to home to be with her sick mom, or go overseas and go pro and make some big money to help out her family. I sat down with Jewel Lloyd, who in real life is a guard for the Seattle Storm of the WNBA, and also Vashti Kola, who directed the short film.
I think for me, He Got Game plays a special part in my life, especially just growing up, you know, loving film, loving New York City. But, you know, I'm not from the athletic world whatsoever. But for me, Spike Lee was a major inspiration for me in my filmmaking journey. And, you know, the movie itself had such like a cultural impact in so many different ways. And, you know, when the project was brought to me, it just sounded so spectacular. I mean, this idea that we would be be telling a similar story, but based from a female point of view. And I think that in 2018, it's sort of like this really wonderful place that we're at, where we're sort of like, we're on this journey where, you know, women are evolving, but also the world itself is evolving. And so we're realizing that a lot of these stories, while they were male dominated like 20 years ago, now it's like, this is a story that can actually impact women, or it is a woman's story also. So I think that there were so many layers to that, and it really inspired me.
Now, it's pretty clear from watching this, Jewel, that the basketball part is easy for you, and I think it better be. I mean, you're dribbling, you're shooting, incredible. Fans already know you for that. There's a little bit of acting in this as well. Does not come naturally to every professional athlete.
Yeah, it's definitely. I mean, the basketball stuff, I was like, all right, like, I should be able to make some shots, or, you know, act somewhat athletic. Definitely, the acting is just different. I took some acting classes before going out to New York. It was good. It was different. You know, you kind of have to be a little vulnerable, which I'm totally fine with. But I think I did pretty well. I mean, you cast Vash.
She did an excellent job.
Now, Vashti, you mentioned that your way into this was sort of a love of film, love of Spike Lee, not necessarily a love of sports growing up. But aside from He Got Game, I mean, do you have any favorite sports movies, or did they speak to you when you were a young kid watching film before you were a film professional?
They definitely spoke to me. I mean, you know, He Got Game was something that was special because, again, it was so cultural. It was definitely more than just about the sport and about being an athlete. It was a story about this kid who grew up in the hood. I grew up in the hood. And, you know, I was involved with sports culture, not as an athlete per se, but like, I love dressing in basketball sneakers, and dressing is sort of athletic. So for me, you know, the fashion, the music, and the culture of it all really appealed to me, as well as the filmmaking.
Now, Jewel, what about you? Did you watch sports movies as a kid? Did any of them hit home with you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a huge fan of Space Jam. I mean, how can you not be? It kind of hits every dimension, and I think that's kind of where I started watching, and was like, man, like, I could play basketball too. Like, I could do that too.
You could be like Mike.
And then obviously watching. Yeah, exactly, right? And then get the, you know, special drink, right?
Now, that being said, most sports movies, and not all, but most sports movies don't have young women and girls as the star. There are a couple of exceptions. But, you know, if you grew up in the 90s and the aughts and you were watching sports movies, or even some of the old classics, you know, Hoosiers, whatever, you're usually watching boys.
Yeah, 100%. And I think, I mean, really the only one is Love and Basketball, right? And it has to have romance in it, right? But it's very rare. So I think that's why this is so special, because it is based on a female's view. And it, I mean, our whole cast was all really female. So I think that's really cool and makes it really special.
Yeah, our crew was an all-female crew, which was, there's a different energy when I think you're working with all women as a woman. So it was really beautiful.
You know, at the same time, Vashti, this trailer, even though it's short, portrays Faith, young player, going through many of the same pressures that a young player would go through, especially a player from a poor neighborhood, maybe, but is not really conscious of the fact that Faith is a young woman. She's just a young athlete with a lot of pressures and professional prospects in front of her.
Right. I feel like there's so many ways you could tell a story about a young female athlete. And interestingly enough, while we were shooting and even reading the script, I never even considered that there isn't this area that we needed to touch on about her being a young woman. And so I think that that sort of, maybe that speaks to where we are in 2018, that sometimes, you know, there are stories that are quite universal. You know, it doesn't matter if the hero is a man or a woman. It's sort of like the story is a story that can touch everyone.
Jewel, did you see any of yourself in this little character sketch? There are some clips of you playing ball as a girl, probably in high school, and pretty much crossing everybody up. I get that part. did you see any of yourself in Faith's story?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I actually went through kind of this whole story on my own. I made a big decision my junior year to leave early, which has never been done before, then go pro. So I ended up going to Notre Dame, actually, and then I went there for 3 years. And I got to a point where I was like, I really want to go pro. I know it's a big decision of leaving school and not graduating, and then having my parents, you know, be like, man, like, you should really stay in school. But then making the big decision by myself to be like, this is what I want to do. You know, if I want to get to the next level, I want to play against some of the best people in the world. So I made the decision to leave after my junior year of college. I ended up getting drafted, and now I'm here in Seattle. But, I mean, it's tough. I mean, you're still a kid. I was, you know, 18, 19 years old trying to make a big decision, right? There's so many things that could go wrong. And that's kind of what faith kind of goes through too. Like, do I make a decision based off my situation with my mom, or do I make a decision based off what I want in my life? So it kind of correlates with everything that went on with me.
Well, Vashti, we're going to go, you know, this short little film, this trailer, you can see it. It has the outlines of a feature length film. It touches all the parts as though you had done it in the proper order, not reverse engineered it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this question's coming. When's the full length script? When's the 2-hour film?
Oh, well, you know, that's something that I'll be discussing with Bleacher Report, I'm sure. And shout out to them, because this is like such a brilliant idea. And, you know, I think that this just leaves it open for, you know, if not us and Bleacher Report, or, you know, like other people, to inspire them to tell a story that's a female hero. And it's a story that everyone can relate to.
Vashti Kola, director of She Got Game from Bleacher Report. Vashti, it's a pleasure.
Thank you so much. You guys can check it out at bleacherreport.com.
Also, Jewel Lloyd, guard with the Seattle Storm and star of that short film. Jewel, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you so much. Go Storm.
I got game. She got game. We got game. They got game. He got game.
In Afghanistan, another day of mourning in a nation plagued by violence. A week after 60 people were killed at a voter registration center in Kabul, a coordinated attack of 2 suicide bombings killed at least 36 people on Monday. 9 journalists were among the dead there, while another journalist was killed in the eastern province of Khost. Even though the U.S. and its allies ended combat operations in Afghanistan in 2014, on the ground, the death toll tells a story of continuing violence. Terror groups regaining ground, successfully mounting attacks against the civilian population. Saeed Kamali Dagan reported on this latest round of attacks for The Guardian.
In the Shashdarak neighborhood in central Kabul, the capital of Afghanistan, not very far from the U.S. embassy and NATO headquarters, there was a bomb at around 8 a.m. and a lot of people died. But within 20 minutes, there was a double suicide bombing as journalists gathered to cover the event, which is why this, you know, event was quite a deadly day for journalists in Afghanistan. 9 journalists died because of these train bombings, mainly because of the second blast that happened very close to the first blast. As journalists, you know, gathered, flooded to the area, you know, to cover the event. Among them was Shah Marai, a very veteran photographer with the Agence France-Presse, you know, somebody who, you know, chronicled the fall of Taliban in 2011, for example, somebody who had worked for the organization for 22 years, you know, and 8 other journalists. Separately, in another incident in the Khost province, hours later, near the border with Pakistan, a BBC reporter with BBC's Afghan service was shot dead. So yesterday in Afghanistan was the deadliest day since the fall of Taliban for journalists. It was a terrible day.
A terrible day indeed. Saeed, this tactic of a bombing followed by another bombing several minutes later is one we've seen before for years, for many years, both in Afghanistan, Iraq, and in other theaters as well. Is there any indication that these journalists were specifically targeted, or did they just happen to be there along with first responders and others who might respond to the initial bombing?
I mean, there are signs that journalists were specifically targeted because back in January, there was another attack, and attacks are quite frequent in Afghanistan. Back in January, the attack was carried out by Taliban, you know, a separate group. The attack yesterday was claimed by ISIS. The Taliban was adamant that there was no civilian, you know, who was killed there, whereas journalists covered the event extensively and demonstrated that a lot of people who died were children, were civilians. So that has made, you know, insurgents in Afghanistan very angry. And that's why they, you know, they're targeting journalists now. These double bombings, as you mentioned, it's been happening in the region a lot. I've seen that in Pakistan, for example, especially when people go to hospitals to attend to the people who've been injured or died in the first blast. And this particular event in Kabul, it was clear that journalists would go in, you know, within less than half an hour. And the fact that, you know, the second person who blew himself up was posing as a journalist is quite a big indication. You know, you have to remember the second attacker, you know, was holding a camera, apparently had a press card. He posed as a journalist to get as close to the journalist as possible. So if you want any evidence that that was targeted as a journalist, I think that shows it.
Saeed, the state of security now in Afghanistan, how safe are civilians now in that country?
I mean, just if you look at this month, you know, last week, an ISIS suicide bomber attacked a voter registration center in Kabul. 60 people died as that result of that attack, 150 people injured. 22 women and 8 children were also, you know, killed at that event. In March, for example, an ISIS suicide bomber targeted a Shia shrine in Kabul, killing 31 and wounding 65. Attacks like this is just becoming so frequent in Afghanistan that is not grabbing the war's attention as much as it deserves. And then the attack yesterday in Kabul was particularly important because we get to see that the people who are trying to draw the attention worldwide are the journalists. Themselves are victims of this, you know, this chaotic situation, tragic situation in Afghanistan. If you see at Shah Marai's pictures, for example, he took very touching pictures, if you know, some of them iconic pictures of Afghanistan. It's through those pictures that we learned about the situation in Afghanistan. And no, you know, he's not there anymore. There was another journalist, Kar Yar Muhammad Tohi, with the Tolo News, the local television in Afghanistan. He was supposed to get married next month. And just on the Sunday, the last weekend, he was out with his fiancée to find out, to look for a wedding hall. When you go and look at these individual stories, you just realize how terrible it is.
Saeed, you mentioned that ISIS claimed responsibility for these twin attacks that we've been talking about. What is the state of ISIS in Afghanistan now? How strong are they? And how are they affecting security on the ground across the country?
Well, we have to say that in Afghanistan, you know, when you look at the broader region, of course, ISIS in retreat, especially in Syria and Iraq, you know, because the main focus was on pushing back ISIS from its main strongholds in those two countries. But as they've retreated, it looks like that they are finding, you know, a new terrain in Afghanistan. But the well-established group in Afghanistan is Taliban. But, you know, ISIS has also, and especially ISIS affiliates, have been very active as well. And they are particularly against the government, which they think is a U.S.-backed government. And they want to impose a harsh form of Islamic rule.
Saeed, before we let you go, a question from the domestic scene here in the United States. We've heard reports over the last couple of days that President Trump has assured individual senators that the United States is soon to be out of Afghanistan completely. No more troops supporting Afghanistan's security forces, ostensibly, and Americans completely out. What does that portend for you, having covered the security situation there?
Looking at Afghanistan is one thing. And looking at the greater region is another. You know, you have to, when you talk about the Middle East, of course, Afghanistan is sometimes not considered as the Middle East, but is on the brinks of the Middle East. This is all a bigger picture that is getting worse and worse. The situation in Afghanistan is getting worse. I'm afraid the bigger picture in the region is grim, and there is not any immediate prospect of any positive change.
Saeed Kamali Dagan with The Guardian. Saeed, thank you.
My pleasure.
And that's all for us today. Thanks so much for being with us this hour. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Hey, we need your help. You are a big part of this show. How we think about things and how we choose what to cover. Got an idea or a guest we should talk to? Get with us on our Facebook page or call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. This is your takeaway.